Right, so here we are on day three of the rainy season retreat of the Glasgow Buddhist Centre, 17th of April 2018. And so welcome to everybody and anybody listening at home, welcome to you as well. So the theme this year is 21st Century Ethics, Bodhisattvas in Training. Last night I gave a talk simply called 21st Century Ethics, and I spoke about what I said was the heart or the essence of Buddhist ethics, as essentially about essentially about taking responsibility for your actions and their consequences. Anyway, after I gave the talk and I sort of handed over the recording device so that the talk could be uploaded to the internet, and I knew it would be going onto the international World Wide Web within a few hours, and I started thinking, so what did I say, and is there anything that, did I get anything right? And in the course of those reflections, I started to realise that were a couple of things that I would like to have said differently, and oh my goodness, it's too late. It's all been published now. So that was a bit humbling. I realised that I had given an account of what the Buddha said to the Kalamans that was somewhat inaccurate, so I'd like to put that right. And I'd also like, I realised that I'd given a rather incomplete account of the heart of Buddhist ethics. So I thought, well, okay, this is an example of realising that my speech had not been entirely truthful. And I felt a bit of remorse about that, so I thought I'd come and confess that and then do my best to make amends. So I realised, well, this is an opportunity for kind of live ethical practice, really. So I was saying to Gina Vangsa, who I was staying with last night, I'm going to start tonight's talk by eating humble pie. And he said, oh, good, Deb, enjoy that. What are you eating humble pie? Yeah, so I would say, in retrospect, it's never too late to put right mistakes, is it? That's the great thing about life. You get something wrong, but you can always go back and say, well, I'd like to put that right. So here goes. I think that in order to be really true to the Buddha's teaching on ethics, I want to add something. I said it's essentially about taking responsibility for your actions and their consequences. Well, that's true, but the emphasis that the Buddha gave to ethics is that ethics starts from within. And the ethical quality of an action springs from its underlying intention. So then that intention is expressed through a bodily action or a speech action or even a mental action. But it starts from within. And it's really good to give attention to that, the origination of actions. We can never know in advance what will be the consequence of what we do. But if we do our best to consider carefully what is likely to result as best we can, and then act with good intentions, will probably have a good effect. I think we can say that. So we can't actually predict what the consequences are going to be. You can never know that. But you can take care to act with good intentions and to just be mindful about your actions. Just consider carefully and act accordingly. And then in hindsight, if it turns out that you've made a blunder, even with the best of intentions, and there's something that you regret and you'd like to have done better, well, you own up to that, and then you do your best to put it right. So you recognize that you did something and it had consequences, and you regret that. So you own up to it, and then you try and put it right. So in this case, as I said, that I gave a rather inaccurate account of the Buddha's teaching, and so you've ended up with a somewhat inaccurate account of the Kalama Sutta. And that is not a consequence as I'd like. I'd like to put that right, so that you get a clearer understanding of what he actually said. By the way, for those of you who are into your Pali suttas, there's a beautiful sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's number 61, and it's the Buddha's advice to Rahula at Ambalatikar. Rahula was the Buddha's son. And he gives this teaching to Rahula where he says, Rahula, do your best to consider before you act. Is this skillful? Will it lead to benefit or harm for living beings? And then go, if you think yes, as far as I can see, then go ahead. But then, later, look back and you actually look at what the consequences actually turned out to be. And if it turns out that your action did harm, then confess that and then make amends. So beautiful little bit of advice. So now I'll get on to the Kalama Sutta, and this is where I'll actually read out the Kalama Sutta. So you can't go far wrong. If you're reading out a direct translation from the Pali, then you've got it as kind of accurate as you could. So here I am getting it out. The right part. Here we are. So this is in the midst of the Buddha's discourse to the Kalamans, and they're asking him what he has to teach, really, and how they know what to believe when they ask a question, ask a teacher what they teach. How can they tell if it's true? So rather than just telling them something, he asks them a series of questions, and he asks them to consider their actual direct experience, and then ask them to tell him what they've noticed about the effect of actions. So he says this: what do you think, Kalamans? When greed arises in a person, does it arise for welfare or for harm? The reply is, for harm, Lord. And this greedy person, overcome by greed, his mind obsessed by greed, kills living beings, takes what is not given, goes after another's wife, tells lies, and induces others to do likewise, all of which is for long-term harm and suffering. Yes, Lord. Now what do you think, Kalamas? When aversion arises in a person, does it arise for welfare or for harm? For harm, Lord. And this aversive person, overcome by aversion, his mind possessed by aversion, kills living beings, takes what is not given, goes after another's wife, tells lies, and induces others to do likewise, all of which is for long-term harm and suffering. Yes, Lord. Now what do you think, Kalamas? When delusion arises in a person, does it arise for welfare or for harm? For harm, Lord. And this deluded person, overcome by delusion, his mind possessed by delusion, kills living beings, takes what is not given, goes after another's wife, tells lies, and induces others to do likewise, all of which is for long-term harm and suffering. Yes, Lord. So what do you think, Kalamas? Are these qualities skillful or unskillful? Unskillful. Blameworthy or blameless? Blameworthy. Criticized by the wise or praised by the wise? Criticized by the wise, Lord. When adopted and carried out, do they lead to harm and to suffering or not? When adopted and carried out, they lead to harm and to suffering. That is how it appears to us. So what the Buddha is saying there is that if you take care of the underlying mind state, the rest naturally follows. And you don't have to worry so much about precepts and training principles if your mind is in a good state. If you're in a positive mental state, then kindness and generosity and consideration tend to naturally flow out from that. And this is a characteristic of the Buddha's whole teaching on ethics, is take care of the mind state as a priority. So I just wanted to add, not just a matter of taking responsibility for your actions, which is how your mind state manifests in the world and their consequence, but also take care of the originating mind state to begin with. Right, so having done my best to put right something that I got wrong yesterday, I now have great pleasure in introducing my friend Pam Chandia, who's sitting right next to me this evening. And we turn now to hearing about Pam's life, and it's more about the whole area of livelihood, having to make a living. Because Pam is somebody who has changed her livelihood quite radically over the years and is now earning a living in a very different way from how she was 10 years ago. And so I think this is interesting to hear from somebody who is now finding a new livelihood, and a new livelihood that is better for her and better for planet Earth. And you'll hear more about that in a few minutes. So, Pam, welcome to the Rainy Season Retreat.
Thank you.
Good to have you here.
Glad to be here.
And first of all, can you tell us what you do for a living nowadays?
Right. So, some of you will have heard that I do a series of workshops for people on climate change called Carbon Conversations. I also do a thing called Climate Conversations, which I helped develop for the Scottish government with a group of other people. And that's a very simple go out and find out what people in Scotland think about climate change. Doing a series of those just now, actually. I also I have a small community interest company called the Surefoot Effect. And I originally set it up just to be a hub for practitioners of work like this, people who work freelance. So we don't have any employees. We're all just freelance, and we use the company when somebody like Scottish Government needs a company to work with rather than an individual. But we also, through the Surefoot Effect, have two European projects with European Union funding. And it's both of them are for raising awareness of climate change in different ways and in different countries. About 3 years ago now, we started developing personal resilience workshops, things to help people who are dealing with climate change and other difficult issues day in and day out. The other things we do, we run workshops for community groups, helping them to define their values. What values do they want to work with? I recently ran a strategy day for a community group. How will we move forward, given where we're at now? How will we sustain ourselves? And I'm also currently working with the Salisbury Center in Edinburgh, which some of you will have heard of, I guess, and helping them to create and implement a 5-year business plan to, again, make the center sustainable so that it can carry its good works forward. So yeah, I do a pastiche of things, mostly around climate change or supporting people in another way.
I was also interested in the work you do in terms of bringing people closer to nature. Could you
say something more
about that?
Yes. One strand I forgot. I haven't done any of it recently. Work with an organization called Natural Change, where we take people out into nature over a series of days and just reacquaint them with nature in a gentle way, and let people spend time having nature be another part of their lives. Our primary goal is to help people become more ecologically and environmentally friendly. But people learn all sorts of things about themselves through the process. I forgot about that specific one.
Thank you. So looking at how you got into all this, I was wondering if there's anything in your childhood that, anything in your childhood that maybe conduced to your ending up in this kind of line of work.
Yeah, a couple of things. I grew up in Michigan, near Detroit, just on the edges of Detroit. So Detroit is a big urban city. It reminds me of Glasgow, actually. Glasgow reminds me of it. Very similar in makeup. But it's in the middle of, I believe there's still 50% forest cover in Michigan, so the state that Detroit is in. And there are lots and lots of lakes and rivers, not many hills. I like the hills in Scotland, I must say. But growing up there, you can't avoid being in nature. And going camping or canoeing or paddling in the nearest little lake, that's just what you do growing up. And you didn't have to go very far to do it. And even as teenagers, that's kind of what we did for fun. You know, we'd go camping for the weekend or canoeing for the weekend. So developed a not only a love of nature, but a sort of need for nature in my life. It was an integral part of my life. In my late teens, some of the rivers near Detroit became so polluted that they were fire hazards.
Gosh.
And, you know, this just appalled me. There are regularly fires on rivers. And so I did various little activist things. I was 16 or 17 at the time, so these activist actions were probably mostly letter writing, but occasionally I went and held up a placard somewhere. I also started recycling at that point because the main problem was people were throwing all their trash into the rivers. And so I was the weird one in the neighborhood. You can drive when you're 16 in Detroit. So I would borrow my parents' car and collect up all the newspaper and cans and bottles and things like that and go to the recycling place. But yeah, that was thought of as pretty strange. Then I went to uni, and I was going to be a lawyer. I wanted to be an environmental lawyer. But after 4 years of, and you have to pay a lot of money to go to university in the States, so I always had a billion part-time jobs, and I was just getting very tired of, not having any money whatsoever. So, and I had discovered computers. And so I went and got a job in computing. And this was a very good time to do that, 79 it was. And, I won't regale you with stories about how computers used to be in the old days. But they were very different than they are now, that's for sure. And it provided me with a really incredible, lucrative career, which in 1981 brought me over here for a 3-year contract. And then I just stayed and stayed and stayed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked in the city of London quite a bit. I did lots of computing for lots of bankers and stockbrokers and credit card companies and, yeah, sat in some meetings that became increasingly uncomfortable to be in, with people talking about, you know, what order should we put the information on the, in the fine print on the back of the credit card statement to maximize our income. And then I finally ended up at a life insurance company here in Scotland, and I had quite a big department of people. And it just became more and more soul-destroying as time went by. And then, I mean, earlier you said I was courageous enough to change careers. I was also, I had an opportunity. So I did actually resign, and my boss pushed the piece of paper back across the table, and he said, let's just talk next week. And I was like, no! He's like, let's talk next week. Okay. So next week, they announced redundancies. So I was like, hello, yes, me, make me redundant now, right away. So I was lucky as well, because I may not have been able to afford to do this career had I not had that money behind me.
Yeah.
It was clear, though, I wanted to stop doing what I was doing. So I then had to decide whether I was going to be a yoga teacher or an environmental architect. Couldn't decide which, and I've always been interested in architecture and houses. If I gave money to charity, it was always to shelter. It's just important to me, houses, homes. So I went on a retreat at Dhanakosha, a week-long yoga and meditation, but yoga retreat at Dhanakosha. And I thought, yeah, well, meditation, that'll be cool, that'll be nice. It's, oh, it's in a nice place, forests, locks, rivers, brilliant. This is it. This is great. So I went to do yoga, and I came out with a meditation practice, and that's when I first met Smriti Ratna. And for a number of reasons, I decided that environmental architecture was what I wanted to do. So I went and did that, a master's degree in that. And after a 4-hour lecture in climate change and the impacts of it and horrible pictures and graphs, I became convinced that I needed to do something about climate change. And building eco-houses is probably actually not the best way to deal with the whole situation. Certainly building eco-houses rather than other types is good. But so that was a long way of seeing how I got to what I do now.
Well, that's excellent, because that's exactly what I wanted you to explain. So somewhere along the line, was that when you came to Dhanakosha? I mean, I think people would be interested to hear about your first contact with Theravada Buddhist community. When you sort of came into the community of Buddhists, was that your first contact, that Dhanakosha retreat?
It was,
yeah. And now you have become a Mitra and really committed yourself to practicing within Theravada. This isn't actually on the list here, but I'm just springing this one on you. But what actually led you to make that decision, you know, to actually want to, you know, really kind of explicitly adopt the Buddhist teaching? And, you know, seriously engage with practicing in a community of practitioners like that?
I think by that time I was 50, and I started practicing with the group in Stirling after the retreat.
After the retreat, yeah.
And I mean, I went on the retreat because that was closest to my house, you know, so there was no kind of selection process there. That was serendipity. But I started practicing with the group in Stirling, and the guy who led the group at that time was just a lovely, lovely, gentle man, and very wise. When he passed away, he was quite young, only in his 40s. I just got this sudden need to not only belong, but to commit to a path.
Yeah.
You know, it was a little, I wouldn't say wake-up call. It wasn't maybe that stark, but it was a call to stop playing around in life and to get a bit more serious about everything.
Yeah.
And also at that time, I think I had, I had already heard all the doom and gloom about climate change and was feeling quite committed to doing something about that. And the Buddhist ethical path seemed to fit really well with pursuing that other path. So,
Thank you. And I know somewhere along the line you decided to go vegetarian. Mm. And in terms of like the influences of the climate change issues and, you know, the Buddhist ethics of respect for life, you know, where was your motivation coming from when you went vegetarian?
Mm. Again, because these paths are parallel, I'm sure they're both informing. But the main decision was because of the impact of particularly large mammals being raised for food on climate change. And so that was my first reason for deciding to become vegetarian. And then it was very easy to then pursue Buddhism in a more ethical way, really.
Yeah.
And to say, okay, good, I can obey that precept now. I can go along with that now.
Yeah.
And it's maybe I needed both things, I don't know.
Thanks. I'd like to talk a little bit about, this is something that interests me because of I've been leading retreats at Dharmakosha for about over 20 years now, and I was interested in what you were saying about bringing people closer to nature, and how, because it's what we do on Dharmakosha retreats as well. I think part of the function of a retreat is to help to start to heal that divide, that split, that alienation from nature that is kind of a feature of modern life. And so, I mean, can you say more about that side of your work?
So I think that alienation is the cause of a lot of problems. If we're thinking about other, then it's easier to not be kind to other. And usually we apply that to people. But then as Buddhists we apply that to animals as well, to other living beings. And certainly if you can then extend that to the world around us, the trees, the hills, the lakes, the rivers, then why would you harm those things as well? And so there's been a lot of studies done about people who get involved in the work that I do in such a kind of obsessive way almost. And most of us have had a pretty deep immersion in nature as children. And we were lucky enough to have that connection as children. And most people respond to spending time in nature just pretty naturally. You know, for a lot of people there's fear. There's a lot of fear. But after you spend a week mostly out of doors, mostly disconnected from all of that.
All of the industrial city life.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. For the people at home, I pointed out the window at Saki Hall Street in the very busy Glasgow.
Yeah.
So most people will respond quite quickly to feeling that they are a part of nature rather than it is something different. And so the theory behind natural change is that people will start to extend their boundaries about what is part of them.
Right.
And nature
right.
can become part of the things that they care about.
Yes.
The things and people and beings that they care about.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's not just something out there.
No.
But it's what I care about, what I love, what I appreciate. Yeah, I get that.
It's similar to, I was always afraid of dogs growing up. And it wasn't until somebody I stayed with wanted to get a dog, and I just really wasn't sure, but ended up loving that dog quite quickly, really.
Yeah.
Just exposure does that.
Yeah. So your experience is that when people start to heal that divide from nature, they tend to become more ethically sensitive to the environment, and they tend to actually feel motivated to do something to save the environment and take responsibility for it. Yeah. Do you think our individual actions, our small individual actions, really make a difference, Pam?
I do. And I was thinking of an analogy today, just on the way here, actually, it popped into my head. Seeing homeless people on the streets, needing money, needing food, needing blankets, needing shelter, really.
Mm.
And we can help one of those people for a meal, usually. Sometimes we can maybe make a bigger difference in their lives. But that does not solve the homeless problem at all. But we do it because we think it will help. And it does help. And when people see other people giving homeless people money or food, they're more inclined to do that the next time. And so that's why I think our actions matter. And telling other people about our actions with regard to climate change matters quite a bit. We need to make it normal. Remember when it wasn't normal to recycle? Now it's pretty normal, and I'm kind of surprised if people don't.
Yeah.
So there's other things that could be made normal as well, and easier. That's the other thing that the government did with recycling. I know it was painful at the start, but they did make it easier. You didn't have to load up your car and drive somewhere like I did when I was 16. You know, you have a bin outside your house now or outside your flat.
Yeah. So that's in the line of government policy. And I know that the Scottish government, climate change issues are quite high on their agenda, and they've commissioned you to do this survey of people's views on climate change in Scotland and their views on Scottish government policies. Do you think Scotland's effort, taking the nation as a whole, do you think Scotland's effort makes a difference?
Yeah, that one took me a little longer to believe. But Scotland passed the most ambitious climate change legislation of any country in the world.
Wow.
About 7 years ago, I think. And so, that's pretty advanced when you think about it. But then you start to think, okay, so we're 5 million people out of however many billion there are now on the planet. However, Scotland doing that, publishing that they've done that, going to international conferences and saying, look what we've done. We want to reduce emissions by 80% by 2050. That speaks to other countries. And you've got to believe it is probably chipping away at the states. One thing you might not know is there's a coalition of mayors in the states. I think there's 300 of them or so now, who have signed up to the Paris Accord themselves. They've just bypassed national government. But part of the reason, maybe, I'd like to think that they have the courage to do that is a little country like Scotland has done it. So why not a big city in the States?
Yes.
So I think It does matter. And Scotland's drive to go toward almost 100% renewable energy, I might get this number wrong, but it's around 68%, I think I read recently, of our electricity.
You mean currently?
Yes.
Yeah.
Comes from renewable resources.
Mm.
That's amazing, you know? That's really good. The other country that we sometimes give a hard time to is China. China is now implementing more renewable energy than it is coal-fired power stations. So, you know.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. It's great to feel proud of your own government.
Yeah.
It really makes me feel good, yeah.
I feel privileged to live and work in Scotland, I must say.
Thank you.
I wouldn't be elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. It's good to hear that. Let's see. Here's maybe a rather difficult one. Do you have any ethical dilemmas in your work, in your livelihood?
I do. Particularly with these European projects. I didn't fly for 8 years. And then I needed to go see my family in the States, so I flew. And so then I became a vegan for a year to make up for that, and it did actually make up for it, carbon footprint-wise. But I've got these two European projects now, and I frequently go to Europe by train. So I had some work in Switzerland in November, and I went by train and came back by train. When I go to France, I do that. Spain. Lithuania was a bit tricky, so I flew. So these things have kind of broken my resolve.
Yeah.
And the second time I went to Spain, I flew. So I'm feeling guilty. But I'm telling myself I'm doing what I can do. Ultimately, the second time I went to Spain, I trained people. So the first time I went, I trained people to do a facilitation of a workshop. The second time I went, I trained people to be trainers of facilitators. So I don't need to go back. So I need to get a bit smarter about what I'm doing with these outreach programs. That is a problem. The other thing is time. I read you my list of things that I do. Sometimes I do way more than that, and it seems like it's all at once. And so my shopping is probably not as ethical or organic or sustainable as it could be. And that pains me as well. So I know what the solutions to these things are. I need to work less, basically. But yeah, I have these all the time, and I give myself a hard time about them. I mostly forgive myself, but I'm very careful because I think a lot of times that forgiveness is me excusing something that, had I thought about my intention and planned enough, then maybe I could do it a different way. But we all do as much as we can do.
Yeah.
And sometimes it is just too hard to think of anything else than going to the nearest big grocery store and getting something wrapped in plastic and sticking it in the microwave when you get home. Sometimes that's all that you can do.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, I guess a lot of people can relate to that. You know, it's just sometimes you just do the easy thing and yes, it's a compromise, but you live with it. Hey. How does your Dharma practice support you in your daily life? Be able to sustain all this?
Certainly. Mindfulness meditation is just essential in terms of being able to keep all this stuff in my head. If I don't let it clear out pretty frequently, then it starts falling out. So mindfulness meditation is just essential. But also, so is the metta bhavana. Both for the situation I just described, forgiving myself, and also for being able to deal with others in the most ethical way possible. So a little story is that I was running carbon conversations for a group of people, and we were talking about clothing. And one woman volunteered that she had bought her daughter 6 school uniforms because she could afford to do so because they were so cheap. So I just didn't say it, but I was having a really hard time getting my mind off the topic of, well, those clothes are so cheap because somebody else's child in a different country is making them and not going to school. So I didn't say it, but more importantly, I had to just put that to the side and deal with it later with a bit of metta bhavana. Because otherwise I wouldn't have been able to continue working with that woman. And the trying to decide whether correcting her, which sounds so judgmental and presumptuous, in that moment, whether that was going to do any good whatsoever. Or was it just going to completely alienate her, or worse, make her feel guilty to no end? Because she really wasn't in a position to do anything else in that circumstance. And it was very, very important to her, for socioeconomic reasons, that her daughter had those new school uniforms. And so, if I hadn't been being mindful, and if I wasn't able to know that I could put that aside and do some loving kindness on it later, I wouldn't be able to continue with that session.
Thank you. This is maybe looking at the dark side of having to deal with climate change. We've been talking about how scary it is and how sometimes it feels overwhelming. And you're somebody who has dedicated quite a large part of your life to actually facing it and trying to help other people to face it too. But do you personally ever just feel overwhelmed with despair when you're facing climate change?
Frequently. Sometimes, you know, it's days and days in a row that I feel like that. There was a time early last year where I just had to back away from it, and I didn't do anything to do with climate change for about 2 months because I just really couldn't. I had a question from somebody in a workshop that really just set me into a quandary. I started to feel that I couldn't ethically reply to people that if we do all this stuff, it's going to be okay. And, you know, that was another one of those, what do I say right here and right now to help this woman with this question? And so I ducked the question a bit, and I just said, I'm a mother, and I want to know that I have done everything I can do to make sure the world my son will be an adult in will be as good as it can be. So I didn't really answer her question directly, but that is an example of how I keep going. That's one of the things that keeps me going. If I didn't act, I would be stuck in despair. Action helps bring me out of despair. And certainly, working with other like-minded people, whether they're working in climate change or social justice or helping animals, it doesn't really matter. people who care about stuff that's bigger than them, that really helps to work with people like that and to be able to share despair.
Mm.
And the workshop that was here last year, the Joanna Macy workshop, that really helped. And I spent a lot of time just sitting. I didn't have a lot of energy at that time, but being able to listen to everybody else really helped.
Mm.
I guess it's a problem shared, as they say. It's a problem halved. But I have to give myself breaks. And that's why we developed this resilience workshop. Because a number of us knew how painful it was for us to deal with these things. And it was good to be able to look at ways, again, that we could help other people, but in doing so, give ourselves skills as well. But yeah, I just need to take breaks occasionally from it. And sometimes I find myself denying the situation as well. And just being aware that I'm doing that is good, because it'd be very easy to just chase that denial and go there and go fly somewhere and buy lots of new clothes.
To hell with the consequences.
And eat a steak and things like that. So that's the danger of not facing it for me. For me. I mean, it'd be different for everybody, I think.
Well, thank you for being so honest. I mean, I'm sure people appreciate. I mean, here you are sitting in front of 25 people that you don't know very well, being very open about your life, including the times of feeling despair. And, you know, you're actually broadcasting across the internet at the same time. It's an amazing act of courage and generosity, Pam, that you're willing to do this. So really appreciate it. So now I'd like to sort of hand over to questions from the floor, from the studio audience on the GBC chat show tonight. 21st Century Ethics Bodhisattvas in Training. So is there anything in Pam's life that you feel maybe resonate with? Anything you'd like to say in response to anything she said, or anything you'd like to ask to draw her out a little bit more about anything she said?
Can I ask a question about the British government?
Mm.
The reason I'm asking this is my daughter was given funding to do an environmental master's degree at Strathclyde University. And that was, it's a European funded. Everyone on that course were all going back to environmental jobs in their own countries. And Louise didn't get a job after her degree because there's no support for, at that time, we're talking, just I think how many years ago, 8 years ago. And she stuck, left the job, went to shelter and various other jobs. But you think, why are we not doing more for the environment at the governmental level?
Yeah, it's another thing I wrestle with frequently. I don't know. I think there's been a political shift in the last 10 years because the UK government also passed a very ambitious target. Not quite as good as Scotland, but pretty ambitious nonetheless. But the support for the government agencies that would support change, those agencies have dwindled, the departments have dwindled, and even in the Scottish government, those departments have dwindled. As economic crisis really is probably the turning point there. And now the focus is on continued economic growth, which just is such an oxymoron. I think that's the problem. The eyes turn to something else. I wish your daughter some luck.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, thank you for just laying out the reality of things, well, in the UK government anyway.
Claire had a question.
Claire.
So I was wondering what did you do when you decided that you needed to work for climate change?
I'll just repeat the question. So what did you do when you decided you wanted to work for climate change?
Yeah, oh, right.
When you had that thought, how did you know, how did you know what your first steps would be?
Yeah.
Right.
How did you decide?
So I was lucky enough to, in Stirling, there was a project started called the Going Carbon Neutral Stirling, just at the same time that I was doing my MSc. In environmental architecture, and I ended up doing that over 4 years, very part time, because I needed to work. I didn't get that big of a redundancy payment, but so I started doing community work in that project, and we went out and we said to people, "Here's a list of actions you must do these," and with our finger pointing at them and shaking, "You must do this and you mustn't do that," and so we had this long list of actions, and then people would go away and they'd come back and say, "Okay, we've done that. What do we do now?" And I was just like, why don't they know? Why do I know and they don't know? I don't understand this. You know, because remember, my degree was in architecture. It wasn't in actions to take for climate change. So I figured it was because I had time and space and I was being paid a little bit to research this stuff. And then that's when I discovered Carbon Conversations, which is a series of two-hour discussions, which gives people time and space to think about, to hear about, to kind of test whether or not they could do an action or not. Mm. And so there was kind of a two-step process. There was this tell thing, which I became increasingly unhappy with, and then a very open way of working. And that open way of working, I was able to take to other community groups. And now a lot of my freelance work is based on that sort of methodology as well, letting people experience stuff rather than telling.
Yes, thank you. Darcy, your question.
Thank you, yes. I'd be really interested, Pam, in the carbon conversations, supposing you've got somebody who's a keen bean and they say, they're talking about carbon emission reduction. What's the one action that if an individual or a household embraces, what is that one action that gives you a yes feeling?
Hmm. For people who can fly, who can afford to fly frequently, that's the one action. Mm-hmm. Cut that down. Okay. Just cut that down. For people who don't fly, pay attention to keeping your heating in your house. So insulation.
Okay.
I mean, that's a pretty simplified view of it, but
thank you, that's great.
Gosh, well, it's really helpful to have it so clear and simple. It's information. Yeah? Anybody else?
Are you ever in a position of talking to climate change deniers?
Oh, yeah.
So can you just repeat the question?
Yeah, so...
What do you say to them?
So the question was, am I ever in a position to talk to climate change deniers, and what would I say to them? Over the last 10 years, that has happened less and less frequently because people are hearing it, you know. People are seeing it, people are feeling it in the weather. People see that things are happening elsewhere in the world. So the message is starting to get through. There are still people, though, who would really like to believe that it's some kind of 10,000-year geological cycle thing or some sun thing, or that really technology will save us and it's okay anyway. And so to those people, all I can do is be gentle and say 99.9% of scientists who look at climate change believe it's happening and believe that humans are causing it. It's unfortunate that the news feels they need to present those two sides as equal.
Mm.
That doesn't help much. But the other thing to say to people is, okay, so let's say that we recycle everything and there isn't plastic in oceans and in whales, and that people have cheap, affordable energy to heat their homes, and that they have good, healthy food to eat. What's wrong with that? All of those things are goals of climate change activism. So we could just pretend. If we don't want to believe, we could pretend it's happening and do all these good things nonetheless. Oil is running out. You know, we're not going to be able to power our world with oil for forever. So, but as I say, in these climate conversations, I was really surprised at, because we were getting people just, we had people out with clipboards bringing people in off the street for focus groups. So they weren't people predisposed to work on climate change. And everybody in those sessions believes it's happening and believes we need to do things. And one of the things they most frequently say is, you know, the government should just tell us what to do. Mm. We're grown-ups, we'll do it. Mm. So that's pretty interesting, too.
Yes. Thank you.
Do you feel optimistic about the future? I know that that's a...
Yeah.
Do you feel optimistic?
Mm. Not always. Right now I do, because I'm helping people in Shetland figure out a local energy plan to implement renewable energy. I see all these people in European countries who are a bit behind where we are in terms of activism, getting more active. I've been asked to come here today to talk about this. You know, so it's much easier now to get people interested. Mm. And so I still have hope that all the actions that are being taken will give us the right result.
Mm.
We just need to keep on doing it and not stop. So every time the governments have a bit of a hiccup on climate change, and when certain countries start doing what they're doing, my home country, that is, I get very worried.
Yeah.
But I am still hopeful.
I think we're heading in the right direction.
Yes. Yes. Definitely.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Yeah, first of all, I just wanted to say well done and not giving into a splurge or a breaking your precepts when you do feel that pain and resistance, you know, because yeah, it's just so easy to have a screw it moment. Well, that's the point. But I think we probably all know what that can feel like. But secondly, I'm interested in your resilience project, because within the area of carers, particularly dementia carers, recently there've been some work done in an organisation, and they've produced a fantastic range of booklets, thematic booklets, it's about 9 in range, just little things with good advice around resilience. I was just interested in what some of the key things were that you guys came up with.
Mm. One of the things that we came up with is that working in groups, and again, giving time and space to it, and it letting people speak to each other in a very genuine way, showing their vulnerabilities, was important. And so booklets are excellent and good, and in fact we handed out a fact sheet in our workshop. But personally, I believe that the workshop was the important bit, and also giving people some skills to work with each other. And a lot of what I do, I like to break the myth of the expert. I I think there's absolutely a place for experts. However, we don't always have access. And being able to talk to a peer about a problem in a structured way is often just as valuable. But again, I'll say there's definitely a place for experts when there's problems. So the group work, for me, all the stuff I do is group work. So I think that's really valuable.
Yeah, that connecting and that understanding and that common.
Yeah.
A potential was dukkha, actually, where there's dukkha.
Yes.
It's really important.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, I've got any. You can get another one.
I've got this view, I'm not interested in this. I saw this program the other day on telly, and there seems to be a thing where we move away from this because that's bad, and we do this, and then this is bad. So we keep on sort of doing that. So it was about Britain and America. America cuts down trees, clear cuts, like swathes, enormous acreage of trees, just kind of completely devastated, so that we can burn wood pellets in our lovely wood burning stoves.
Mm.
And they're now on the program, it looked, they're supposed to take old wood or not very good wood, put it like that, but actually there was a whole range of wood. Some of it about 100 years old, according to the people on the programme. And, you know, yeah, so Ben challenged the businesses. You know, they were saying they were doing everything as they should do it, basically. You know, and they were keeping to the lighter stuff. But yeah, it's this kind of corruption and... I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know, I mean, I could say lots about that. I'll try and encapsulate it a bit. I think that people were mistaken to think that wood fuel is a sustainable, carbon neutral, any of those words, resource. It just isn't. Aside from the fact that there isn't enough arable land on the planet, and trees don't grow fast enough for us to be able to power all our needs that way. So, yeah, mistake. And there's probably other mistakes being made. I read today about a plastic eating enzyme. And that just worried me a little bit. It developed itself, evidently, on a rubbish tip. So I was like, whoa, a little scary. So I don't know what I'm not going to go further on that one, but doing less would be a very good precept, really, for this whole problem. You know, why do we have all this plastic in the first place? Textiles is something that nobody really mentions much about, but our clothing is fast becoming one of the biggest carbon emitters in the world, because everybody needs new clothes and more of them, and they just throw out the old ones, and the manufacturing process causes more carbon emissions. So that whole problem would be resolved by just having less clothes and fixing them. So there's any number of examples like this where less is better.
Okay.
One more question. It was actually today, I was just renewing my contract with my power supplier, right? And one of the suggestions they've given me is to save money was to use an air heat pump.
Wow.
Right? Only thing is the cost is £11,000 to put this into your house, a three-bedroom house. You recoup the cost after 8 years. But how does that affect the carbon? You know, if everybody went did that, would that be a good thing for the world?
That's hard to say. I mean, I guess your energy supplier didn't offer you a renewable energy source.
Well, I don't know. It's E.ON. I don't know. what, how much you will they do.
Yeah. For me, that would be a more direct route, is to buy renewable energy. And so E.ON might have a renewable energy tariff, or there's lots of companies out there that do it. Those are more expensive, but £11,000 is going to buy you a lot of years of slightly more expensive renewable electricity.
Oh, yeah.
So that would be what I would say to you, to just have a look at that. I don't know enough about heat pumps to be able to say.
It's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
Because the big problem I've got is renewables are brilliant, but you've still got to have a base load somewhere. And how do you generate your base load? And that's the problem that I see with green energy.
It's the mix.
Yes, the mix.
The mix. You need
to. But how do you generate your base load? That's the problem.
Hydro, usually. But anyway, we'll talk about this after Gila.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah, I understand that there are a lot of advances in terms of renewable energy about, you know, the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine. A lot of the time when the sun isn't shining, the wind's blowing. So they do cover each other to some extent. But what do you do when neither the sun is shining nor the wind is blowing? Well, people have been working on that very seriously in terms of developing, for example, batteries. Another one is pumping water uphill and then letting it flow down again and drive turbines. A number one is generating hydrogen using electrolysis and then using the hydrogen to produce energy. So there's a whole series of technological solutions, and they're advancing all the time in the problem, and they're getting closer and closer to a solution. So this thing about how we still need nuclear power stations, etc., because of base load, is starting to become actually out of date.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I have a question. So I saw this movie Cowspiracy. Have you seen it?
No, I can't. I can't bring myself to watch it. I know what they're going to say.
So it's interesting because you're talking about carbon conversations and climate change. And, I mean, I can't remember everything that they said in this movie. But essentially what they found was, you know, when this guy had done this research, was that, you know, the biggest contributor to climate change is what we eat.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, dairy and meat. And so I'm just interested in your kind of response. And you haven't seen the movie, but like I'm sure that information is out there in that kind of community. So I'm just interested because he ran into a lot of difficulties with these environmental organizations not wanting to talk about that.
Right.
So that was the whole emphasis in the movie was, you know, Sierra Club, Rainforest Network. They just don't want to talk about it because they get funding from these from the dairy industry.
Yep.
And so I'm just interested, like...
Yeah.
They want funding from people as well. Like, they need the support of the general public, don't they? And if you tell someone very strongly that they can't do something that they're very attached to doing, they're not going to be very happy.
So that was the reason I stopped eating meat.
Right.
Was because of the high carbon impact. And I don't do very much dairy either. I avoid it as much as I can. I eat eggs, but So, the difficulty is that, well, there's so many aspects to it. I mean, people think that they wouldn't be able to live without meat and dairy, milk in their tea, you know, it's so important. People's livelihoods rest on this, but increasingly fewer and fewer actual people because of the mechanization of the dairy industry. And, you know, I mean, if we think ethically about how those animals are treated, you know, we might stop. As part of Carbon Conversations, we talk about food, and we point out to people that the two biggest things in our list are beef and cheese, and chicken is actually under cheese as having a high carbon impact, and people are shocked. And people often respond by saying, you know, I think I could eat meat less frequently. Mm-hmm. And that's, for me, that's the way to go with people is, you know, we need to reduce. For me, the scariest thing is that developing countries are aspiring to eat as much meat and to take in dairy when they never had a cultural history of using dairy products. And so the developing world is starting to aspire to the things that we're just starting to realize we shouldn't be doing, including cars, you know. So, yeah. So I think that's probably why I didn't want to watch it, because it would just be more, oh, no, it's not working. But, you know, again, awareness is raising about this, certainly in the UK. So, yeah, we'll see.
It just feels like a real inconvenient truth in terms of, you know, the whole conversation around climate change. And,
absolutely.
I mean, I wasn't even really aware of it until I saw that movie, but, now it just sort of, see it sort of the dodge, you know?
Yep.
People dodge it.
Yep, yep. It's another one of those things like, I need my holiday, I have to fly.
Yeah, exactly.
I need meat or I will not be happy. I need milk or I will not be a healthy person. Because it's easier than figuring out the alternatives. Sometimes it's cheaper than the alternatives. Sometimes your family won't let you change. Makes it difficult. I lived in a house where I had to prepare 3 evening meals for a long time. And live with the implications of that.
Well, we've run out of time for questions, but there's obviously a lot of interest in finding out how to reduce our impact on climate change. You know, people, now that we've got talking about the dreaded ogre of an issue together, you know, people are actually genuinely interested about, well, what are the things that I could do or not do, and so on. So, if people wanted to follow up, I mean, we've already got the book that you published in the GBC bookshop with all the information that you put out to Carbon Conversations groups. Are the Carbon Conversations groups going on in Glasgow? People could join if they wanted to, do you know?
I don't know of one now, but if enough people got together, I'd be willing to make one happen.
Thank you very much. That'd be really fun, and this will be a lovely
place to do it.
Yeah, great. So if people are interested in following that up, you could, like, form a group, share your concerns, share your interests, find out, and do it communally.
Yep.
Sounds like it's the best way.
Yep. And there's a way that you get led through the sessions, so I'd be happy to share that.
Good, thank you. Okay. Well, that's all we've got time for tonight in terms of meeting Pam Chandia. So our new Mitra, now living in Paisley, now part of the Glasgow Sangha. So welcome, and thank you for sharing tonight, Pam.
Thank you.